The Second Impeachment Trial of Donald Trump, Analysis and Perspective. The impeachment trial underway in the U.S. Senate has already moved to its next phase, as senators yesterday voted that the trial itself is constitutional. Today, the House managers begin to present their evidence against former President Trump, and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has stated that there will be new evidence. Most observers believe that in the end, Mr. Trump will not be convicted, that there will not be enough Republicans in the final count. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the historic nature of the impeachment and what happens next. The Senate is in uncharted territory. Never before has a past president faced a Senate trial. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. It is day two of the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Today, we are going to talk about the constitutional, political, and historic issues at stake. My guests are Gene Cummings, who is political editor for The Wall Street Journal, and Joseph Reissert, who is professor and director of the Integrated Studies Program in the Department of Government at Colby College. We invite your comments and questions. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Already good questions coming in. And Gene and Joseph, thanks so much for coming. And welcome back to Maine Calling, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with both of you. I told the audience that we would offer perspective and analysis this hour, and I'm going to start with the perspective. And Joe, as you watch what's going on, as you read about what's going on and talk with your colleagues in the government department, what is the perspective that you can give the rest of us who I think at this point don't know what to make of all of this?
Well, that's a great question. You know, opinions vary. My colleagues have different views. I think, I can only really speak for myself. I just wonder what's actually going to be accomplished by this process. President Trump lost the election. He's out of office. Joe Biden is the president. Most of the folks who want to see President Trump impeached and convicted have probably wanted to see him impeached and convicted since the election back in 2016. Most of the people who think he shouldn't be are the people who've liked him all along or who've been kind of stuck with him because they're Republicans. And I don't see a lot of minds being changed. So.
And Gene, you have been a reporter in Washington for 30 years, and I'm wondering what the sense is there in Washington. Is it that this is all surreal? Is that this is exhausting? Or is there an electricity that this is history in the making?
Well, I'd say there are all sorts of emotions, including every one of the emotions you just mentioned. There also is a fair amount of fear. Basically, the city was like a war zone and has been so for about a month. There are many people who live near the Capitol. We have reporters who were in the field. And this is nothing we've seen in the time I have been here. And I think it's not close, but if you go back to 2000, where the election was in dispute, you know, we did have the Brooks Brothers little mob scene down in Florida during the recount. But no one was looking to harm someone else. They were looking to stop the voting in the recount. And they did, in a sense, accomplish that by disrupting the recount in Florida. But no one was carrying weapons and, you know, looking to harm other people. This was entirely different. I think that there was not just physical fear that lingers in the city, but there was also, I think, a lot of people who were genuinely concerned for the democratic process. We've never seen anything in recent memory and in modern history that threatened the electoral process like this did. And even in 2000, after the Supreme Court ruled, Al Gore gave a concession speech and walked away. And there were Democrats then that felt like they had been robbed of the election results, but they accepted them. So that might be similar to what we're experiencing, but on a scale now, it's entirely different.
Joe Reiser, let's talk about the big question yesterday about the constitutionality of even having a former president undergoing an impeachment trial after he has lost the election and is no longer president. Is your read, I have heard a couple things. I have heard that, you know, this is up for debate whether or not this is constitutional. And then I ran into a neighbor of mine who is a judge, and he said, if you read the Constitution carefully, there is no question. Of course, this is what the framers wanted. What do you think, Joe?
I think it's not as clear as all that. You know, if you read the text, you can make textual arguments kind of either way. So one of the key arguments in the Democratic brief is from Article 1, Section 3, which is the portion of the Constitution describing the powers of the Senate. There it says the Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments, right? And so here the theory is once the House of Representatives has impeached someone, and there's no dispute that they can pass articles of impeachment against the sitting president, and when the articles were passed, Donald Trump was president. So that would be an argument, a textual argument in favor of holding the trial. The textual argument against it is Article 2, Section 4, the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. So there it seems pretty clear that what's being contemplated is primarily removal from office. You know, there are interesting historical arguments that can be made. Obviously, we adapted the process of impeachment from the British practice. In the British practice, former officials could be impeached, but our practice departs in a lot of ways from the British one. Non-officials could also be impeached by Parliament. The punishment in the case of a conviction could include forfeiture of goods, I mean, any of the criminal penalties, including death. Obviously, we don't do that. So, and then there's the case of Secretary of War William Belknap from just after, 1876. The Senate decided it had. So he was impeached by the House for basically financial corruption, which it appears he was clearly engaging in. He resigned to avoid a Senate trial. The Senate then took up the question, well, should we go forward or not? By a majority, less than a two-thirds majority, they decided to go forward. When Belknap was ultimately acquitted, though, most of the votes no. So a majority voted to convict him, but it takes a two-thirds majority to convict someone in a trial of impeachment. Most of the no votes went on the record afterwards saying they didn't think the trial was proper. There was no jurisdiction. And so, you know, that seems to be our situation. That is to say, a majority of the body thinks it is proper. A minority thinks it's improper. The last time this situation arose, the people in the majority didn't feel bound by the vote of the majority, and so voted acquittal on this ground. And I think that's what we're likely to see this time, too.
Gene Cummings, was the outcome yesterday really ever in doubt?
No, it wasn't. We assumed that those, because we had the test vote a little over, several weeks ago about whether this was constitutional or not. And so that was an early indicator of where most of the Republicans were going to come down. The surprise yesterday was Senator Bill Cassidy changing his vote. He joined five other Republicans in voting to move forward and said afterwards he felt like the House impeachment team made a compelling argument that it was proper for them to move forward, even though the president was no longer in office. And so we have that. And then we have today Mitch McConnell, the Republican minority leader in the Senate, indicating this is a vote of conscience. So he's not whipping it. And we'll see if that gives other Republican senators a bit more room to consider the evidence in a different way. But I do agree with Joe. I don't believe that they will get 17 Republicans. Right now there are six. And that doesn't, and Bill Cassidy's vote yesterday does not presume how he will vote when it comes to guilt or innocence, just was a process vote. Mm-hmm. So I think that there could be a few surprises.
Gina, I'm going to come back to you for this one. I'm so glad you brought up Bill Cassidy. And I was going to ask you if you thought that that might be a sign of what's to come. But Chuck Schumer, as you know, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has said that there will be new evidence presented. Do you have any sense of what that might be and if it is powerful enough to sway more Republican votes?
Well, from what I understand, and the House prosecutors have kept this very close to the vest, so it's been a hard reporting job to figure out what they've got. What the impression that we have based on our reporting is that they have different footage that has not been seen before. So that could be one direction that they go. I thought it was interesting in their opening arguments. They also got into more detail about the injuries to the Capitol Hill police officers. That's an area that's not been thoroughly explored. So that could be, you know, they talk about this, their approach being to a criminal case. And so would they go down that road? Because that's real bodily harm. But really, other than new video footage and maybe a new line of questioning, I'm not sure that we know what they claim will be new. The other thing is that they could also connect dots that we know are out there, but in a new and different way or a more compelling way. And we had heard them talk about how this is not just about January 6th, but everything that led up to it. So will the House prosecutors bring back Trump's comment in the first presidential debate when he told the Proud Boys to stand down and stand by? Will they argue that that was the first or one of an earlier signals that Trump may try to rally Proud Boys and other supporters? Will they argue that that is part of his attempts to, or lay the groundwork, if necessary, as a last ditch, to try to incite a mob?
Joe Reiser, does this vote have to be a public vote? Could there be a private vote in the end about whether or not to convict the president?
That's a great question. You know, I think, look, the Senate gets to define the rules of its trial. The Constitution it does not specify that it has to be, that an impeachment vote has to be public. Now, I'd have to look it up, but I think it doesn't take much to force a vote on the records. I think it only takes one. I'd have to look it up. So you would need deeply robust consensus in the Senate to have a secret vote. You know, it does seem like it would be, I think folks who like the president would find it shockingly unfair. Folks who would be glad to see him removed, I suppose, would be happy to see justice done, and then they might reasonably analogize the proceeding to a jury vote, where, you know, the jury does not have to generally vote in public, right?
And Gene, have you heard any talk of that idea being floated?
I have not, and I would agree with Joe that I think the president's allies would definitely object, because twofold, it doesn't, you know, it's the easy way out, and their constituents really have a right to know where their senators are going to come down on this. And then secondly, I think the president wants to know where people stand, because clearly in the House, the 10 House Republicans are now, who voted to impeach, are now targets, and a similar list of targets will come out of the Senate vote.
Right. I wanted to ask you, Gene, what all of this means for the future of the Republican Party.
It's really hard to tell right now. I think we have so many moving parts and so many next steps that could influence where the party goes. I think there are, you know, some of the data that you look at, we see a lot of Republicans who are changing their party registration to independent, if not Democrat. I think it's over 150,000 nationwide have done that. That's a New York Times report today. There also are changes at state party levels that are happening in Michigan. Members of several militia groups have now become local and state party officials. We haven't seen that to the degree that we're seeing it in Michigan. And so this is an ongoing process. We also see Republicans like Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and really Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the third highest ranking Republican in the House, who are trying to make a stand for the traditional Republican Party. So we, you know, there's always been this talk of a civil war, but the establishment hadn't stayed within the party to try to take up such a fight. Well, they are now. So they definitely, in the next couple of years, we will see this unfold before us. It is possible that the Republican Party will emerge as something entirely different than what we knew, you know, just 4 years ago. But that's not unheard of. The parties go through these changes. You know, in the 60s and 70s, when the South turned against the Democratic Party because of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, we saw a transformation of the Democratic Party. Really, in 1994, when Newt Gingrich led Republicans to the majority in the House, that Republican Party that emerged was edgier and more confrontational than the one that lived before it. So we've been through these transformations before. The two-party system managed to survive, and we may be, and I think we are, undergoing a similar transformation.
And Joe Reisert, I want to ask you the same question, but we need to take a break. I'll have to do that afterwards. We'll also hear from you in the audience. This is Maine Calling, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a quick email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment on Facebook. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Ocean View at Falmouth, with the goal of promoting optimal health through active retirement living. OceanviewRC.com.
As President Biden pushes for the federal minimum wage to more than double to $15 an hour, we'll explore what life is like for people who make below that amount.
I know so many folks come to my job and they see me smile at McDonald's and I'm happy, but they don't know that I haven't seen a doctor in 18 years.
The history behind the fight to raise the minimum wage, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. A reminder about our Maine's Political Pulse podcast and corresponding newsletter. Maine's Political Pulse is a weekly discussion on the politics here at home with our two top Maine public news political reporters, Steve Missler and Mal Leary. The Political Pulse podcast and newsletter are both available online at mainepublic.org. You can have the Political Pulse newsletter delivered straight to your inbox on Friday mornings by subscribing at mainepublic.org/pulse.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, analysis of the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Joining me, Joe Reisert, Colby College professor and director of the Integrated Studies Program in the Department of Government, and Gene Cummings, Wall Street Journal's political editor. We want you to share your comments and questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Joe Reisert, the same question to you that I asked Gene Cummings before the break. What does this mean for the future of the Republican Party? And do you see any historic examples that are instructive as we think about this?
Well, first of all, I want to agree with just about pretty much everything Gene said. That is to say, you know, there are a lot of moving parts here. We don't really know what the outcome is going to be. You know, there clearly are, it's already appears to be a primary challenge to Liz Cheney. So there's going to be some of that, right? Some political fighting within the Republican Party as people who oppose the thing try to oust representatives and possibly senators who supported impeaching President Trump. But, you know, a year from now, we might have forgotten this whole trial. I mean, think about how quickly the first impeachment kind of disappeared off the national conversation and radar. On the other hand, this could become enormously salient. And, you know, part of what seems to be happening in the Republican Party is that Donald Trump articulated certain issues and appealed to certain demographics, right, seemingly bringing into the Republican Party, say, the white working class, appealing to them in a way that a candidate like, you know, businessman Mitt Romney never did or could. You know, President Trump made kind of immigration control and, you know, onshoring of manufacturing, bringing it back from China and elsewhere, right? He makes these central issues. They had not really been central Republican issues. As he made them more salient, he's beginning to change the coalition. So a question is going to be, does the Republican coalition going forward look more like the Trump coalition, right? Or is there any path back to that sort of older Republican coalition? Did the Republicans get back, you know, the suburbanites who were kind of appalled by all the Trump drama and so voted for Biden and normality and seemingly cost Trump the election?
An email here from Jeff. Mr. Trump is now a private citizen. However, he was impeached during his active presidency. Who will foot the bill for the legal fees for his second impeachment trial? The federal government, because he was impeached before he left office, or Mr. Trump himself, because he's now a private citizen? Gene, do you know the answer?
You know, it's a good question. I really don't know the answer. I believe that the Trump campaign had suggested they were using, you know, money that he was raising post the election day to finance some of his court fights. But I'm not quite sure who, if impeachment, you know, falls into that particular category. And Jen, if I could just add one comment on what Joe was talking about mm-hmm. in terms of the coalition. Recently, I was in a conversation with a Republican strategist, and they were talking about the sort of changing demographic of the Republican Party, the Trump Party. And they know that working class element, they need and want to keep that. But where they said they suffered the most consequential losses were with college educated white men. which not much focus had been on. Mm. There was a lot of coverage of college-educated white women, and their flight from the Republican Party was evident in the midterms 2 years ago. But in the presidential, they viewed the loss of college-educated white men as the bruising blow. So how do they nip those two and try to bring those men back? They view that as their challenge.
We'll go to Harry, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Harry. Go ahead.
Hi. So I was just listening to the previous caller talking about how the change of the different political parties. And I personally believe that we're at a crossroads in which we don't need the two political party system. And as we've seen with the change in the Republican Party, with the rise of modern conservatism and that kind of what we saw in the splinter of the election of the people going for the need for normality, voting for Joe Biden. I think we're also seeing that splinter in the Democratic Party, as I, as a young voter, am not turned on by the Democratic Party anymore because they don't view and share any of the same values. So I think it's time that we get rid of the two political party and start focusing on actual issues instead of what the Democrat thinks is best, what the Republican thinks are best. And it's just really time to start dealing with problems instead of this two-party system just going back and forth. Thank you so much.
Harry, thanks so much for calling. Joe Reisert, Harry identified himself as a young voter. You spend your days with young voters. What do you think the chances are that, you know, in the near future, we may not have this two-party system?
I don't think the chances are good. There's kind of a structural, there are institutional and structural reasons why we sort of repeatedly gravitate back to two parties. That and even when third parties have emerged, you know, the populists say, you know, their issue, or Ross Perot in the 90s, the issue that gets brought to the fore by the third party tends to get taken over by one of the big parties, right? And the issue is simply the winner. We have plurality first past the post elections in general, and you know, if whoever gets the most votes, even if it's only 40%, wins, right, then there's a strong incentive to have candidates who are going to get that plurality. And the more candidates you have, the more likely it is that, you know, you're wasting your vote.
Gene, I'll turn to you. And Harry is expressing a sentiment that a lot of young voters have on both sides of the political spectrum, that the party as they see it does not respect what they care about.
I think that that's very much a sentiment among young voters. My daughter has been trapped here with me for over a year, and she's a young voter. She is 21, and she has expressed frustration with the two-party system. But I do agree with Joe, certainly in the near term, the structural issues are very difficult to overcome. Just in terms of getting on ballots. And I mean, the rules were written by the two big parties, and they were written to keep a third party out, period.
Harry, thanks so much for your call and for being a part of Maine Calling today. An email here from Roger. Why doesn't the United States Supreme Court weigh in on the constitutionality of the Senate trial? It seems their decision would lend credibility to either side's argument. Joe?
There's something called the political questions doctrine. And basically what the court hasn't ruled on exactly this issue. There was one of the impeached federal judges a while back objected to the way the Senate internally organized the trial. And the Supreme Court's and this judge sued, and the Supreme Court heard his case and basically said the Constitution tells us that the Senate gets to hold a trial and the Senate gets to decide what the trial looks like. And, you know, I think the Supreme Court would clearly want to kind of stick with that line and say, you know, this is a decision the Constitution has left to the House and Senate, and they wouldn't want to intervene.
Gene, I'm going to we have two related questions. I'll read both to you. One is from Friedrichs, who writes, I read that if 20 Republicans don't vote at all, that could lead to Trump's conviction. Could you comment on that? And Louise on Facebook, is it possible that not all GOP senators will be present for the vote? What are the rules and what are the options? So clearly something that's kind of going on, going around out there in social media world.
Yes, it is 2/3 of those who vote. So it's, you know, technically, yeah, maybe something like that could happen. I think the senators are going to be under incredible pressure to go on the record here. And so I think the likelihood that 20 would abstain or not show up, I just can't see that happening. They're sitting there. They're in the room. So they are engaged. And I think it would be viewed as a complete cop-out by everyone if people just, you know, decided to abstain.
We'll go to Ken calling from Portland. Hi, Ken. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to the question of what is the impeachment going to result in? And I worked for 20 years in corporate America. Then I worked 20 years in teaching at local schools here in Portland. And what I found in corporate America is if somebody had a egregious sexual harassment case or safety, if we had a safety concern, you would fire the person, not just for the target of firing that person being the target, but for the target audience. You want to make sure that the message is sent that this is not appropriate and we won't put up with it. As far as in teaching, if a kid was disrespectful in the classroom, you eject them from the classroom to send a message. This is not appropriate. If we don't send that message, then how are we as a country going to go forward?
And Ken, let me ask you this. In your view, is holding the impeachment trial enough to send the message, or would there have to be a conviction?
No, there doesn't have to be a conviction. I think that from Donald Trump, it may not be enough, but I think there's a lot of people that would be worried about what their legacy is going to be. So I think what it does do is it holds him accountable to the legacy. It holds him accountable to the fact that, and also to our country, to the fact that we as a country will not condone this. You may not get thrown in prison as a result of this. I mean, you know, you may not get thrown out of school. If I ejected somebody in corporation, the union might have come back and said, okay, you know, we'll, you know, they might have won the case. But the fact is that you tried and you sent a message that we as a corporation or we as a school will not condone this. That's enough.
Sure. Jean, thoughts?
Well, that certainly is one of the main arguments by the impeachment prosecutors, is that this needs to happen in order to send the message and put a check on future presidents, that they can't spend, you know, the last weeks in office doing egregious things and then just walk away with no penalty. That's one of their chief arguments. And, you know, when you look at what happened here, and those of us here in the city, it could have been so much worse. And I'm not sure, and maybe through the trial, the public will become more aware of how close we came to an absolute horror and tragic story. I mean, if you think, when you listen to the anger and the fury of the protesters who were chanting Pence's name, think about what they would have done if they had gotten their hands on him. And they came very, very close. There was, when they were moving Pence, the protesters were less than a minute away from him. It could have been an absolute horror story here. And that is one of the reasons, that one of the primary reasons that they are trying to send a message that this cannot be condoned, because the next time, and there'll probably be a next time, there might be a better plan on behalf of the protesters. And it really is scary to think if they'd had a better plan, what would have been the outcome?
Mm. Joe, is the impeachment trial itself enough to send a message to future politicians who might be in a position to tamp down their rhetoric?
I don't know that it's the trial. I mean, I think it's the widespread reaction of, discussed, basically. It's one thing to pursue your legal options when you've lost an election, right? And people expect that. That's what Al Gore did. That's fine, right? But there comes a point when your legal options are exhausted. You know, when Attorney General Barr comes to you and tells you that your claims are BS. I won't say it on the radio. Right, it's time. And then all the rest of that conduct, you know, was self-evidently bad sportsmanship, self-pitying, revolting. You know, I mean, you can elaborate that, and I think that reaction has been widespread. I mean, I think if the question is, you know, did Donald Trump incite insurrection? I mean, that's what the article of impeachment says. You know, I think that case is extremely hard to make. If you read, I mean, yes, did he speak recklessly about the election after his lawsuits came up nothing? Yes, he did. You know, the January 6th speech, though, at most seems to envision that there's going to be a big rally, that the rally is going to stiffen the spines of the vice president, who Trump seemed to believe had the authority to not count electoral votes from states that were disputed. He didn't, and Pence acted properly. Seemed to think that maybe this would stiffen the spines of senators and members of the House to object and disqualify some of the ballots. I mean, you know, there's no evidence in the speech that he's calling for the overthrow of the government, or, you know, he's going to institute martial law, whatever some of the rioters and may have believed.
Ken, thanks so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can post a comment to our Facebook page, tweet at Maine Calling, or send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Jackson Laboratory, a nonprofit where scientists use the power of genetics and genomics to search for cures for disease. Learn more at jax.org. Our special coverage of the Senate impeachment proceedings are expected to continue today at noon. Maine Public Radio will provide live NPR coverage until 4 o'clock this afternoon, at which point we'll bring you the day's full news on All Things Considered. On Maine Public Television, we'll carry live coverage from PBS NewsHour throughout the day, and we'll provide complete coverage as it happens on our website at mainepublic.org. If you haven't yet joined our All Books Considered book club, now is a great time to get a jump on our next selection, Writers and Lovers by award-winning Maine author Lily King. Maine Calling producer Cindy Hahn will host the Writers and Lovers virtual book club meeting featuring Lily King on Thursday evening, March 25th. To sign up or to learn more about Maine Public's All Books Considered book club, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and we are discussing the significance and outlook for the second impeachment trial of former President Trump. My guests, Gene Cummings with The Wall Street Journal and Joe Reisert with Colby College's Department of Government. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Sacco and Ethan. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I wanted to respond to, I think it was Ken, and then your female guest host there. We're not talking about here on this show, you guys aren't talking about the forgotten part of a lot of America that feels like that what happened was almost like a Reichstag fire. There was something people knew, something, you know, was going on. And, you know, there were 500,000 or 250,000 people outside at the Trump rally. Now, what he said, was that completely innocent? No, he did rile people up. But all the people that were there, and they were baby strollers and families and whatnot, but all those people were outside. A few select people penetrated and got in. And what happened in there, no, it was wrong and terrible, and no one really knows exactly. But here we are reacting to what happened and trying to impeach Trump again. And again, I said, he's not completely innocent in this, but it seems like we're reacting and we're not really considering all that happened. And I think it's wrong.
So, Ethan, are you saying that you think the impeachment trial is an overreaction?
Yes, and I think that what we're doing is we have political theater in Washington. We're not getting answers. We're just reacting. These people get, our representatives get $250,000 a year, and all they do is continue to put us further in debt and run this. It's like basically political theater. Is anyone really getting to the bottom of what happened?
Sure. Okay, Ethan, thanks for your call. And Jean, I'm going to toss it to you.
Yes, we will get to the bottom of it to the extent that we can, because there is one of the biggest FBI investigations since 9/11 going on right now. And so we will have some sense eventually about, were there organizers, were there planners, was there coordination, who did it? We'll have their names. We'll know who led it. Now, the caller makes a very valid point that there were, you know, lots of people who were at the rally who did not breach the Capitol. They did not. They just attended a rally and then, you know, went back to their hotels or whatever, or milled around outside of the Capitol without doing any other harm. But there were people who didn't do that. And they are the ones that are targeted by the FBI. And so we will have a sense of what actually happened. We have footage of what actually happened. And so it's not as if like a dozen bad guys, you know, kind of went off the rails. It's hundreds of people. They've already charged more than 200 people. So it was a large group of people. And the police officers, you know, had to fend them off. We have video of we took a video and broke it down. It's on the Wall Street Journal website. The Capitol Police held them off for 2.5 hours. So this was a very significant clash, and one that is it's important, as you say, that we get to the bottom of it. And I think for a long time, we've been hearing from Homeland Security that domestic, homegrown groups were are one of the biggest threats to the country and our democracy, but they didn't seem to know very much about them and how they operated. Well, now they've got more than 200 who've been arrested, and I suspect that the FBI and Homeland Security are in the process of learning a lot more about really what is the degree of a threat that comes from these groups.
Mm. Joe Reiser, we started this program by asking broad perspective, and I wanted to ask you, among scholars that you've talked to, government and constitutional scholars, do you hear any of them saying that the impeachment trial is an overreaction?
I think the majority view is that it's appropriate. I would say that. I mean,
okay.
You know, yeah. Scholars are like 80-90% Democrat. So, and I should say, I think it's an overreaction, and I'm a Republican. So that, you know, there may be a correlation to all of that too.
All right, we'll go to Sal calling from Standish. Hi, Sal. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi there, Jennifer. I got to the show a little late today, but I just was, you know, the last thing I heard was somebody mentioning, you know, Trump didn't actually specify for anybody to do damage to the Capitol or any of that stuff, which I think is absurd because no one in their right mind would ever do that. What he did do, however, was weeks before or months before, I don't remember now, when somebody mentioned the Proud Boys to him, at first he denied knowing them or knowing of them. And then he told them specifically, stand back and stand by. So he knew, aside from the FBI, you know, making everyone aware that they were expecting violence, he knew that those people, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, and others, were totally in support of him, and that they were violent groups.
So when he made the statements he made on January 6th, he knew that those violent groups would be listening to him and how they would take his message. That's
sure,
all
and,
that I
and
have to say.
Jean, I think that Sel, I'm so glad you called. And Jean, I think that she is hitting on the crux of this whole thing, isn't she? How do you interpret what was said, and not just exactly the words, but what was meant by those words? And was it reasonable to expect that anybody would expect the same reaction from those words?
Well, and that is what the trial is about. And as I said earlier, I think that comment the former president made during the first presidential debate, I think we're going to hear it again as the House prosecutors try to lay out their case.
It's in their brief.
Pardon?
It is in their brief.
Yeah. I think we're going to see the footage of that again. So, you know, I think that that goes to the very heart of the argument in the impeachment trial. What should Trump have expected would be the reaction by that crowd to what he was doing. And we'll see where the senators come down.
Sel, thanks for your call. Going to Lori, calling from Denmark. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was calling kind of in the same manner, reacting to Ken and the person who spoke after him. I just think that it's really kind of absurd to, I have to take exception to what they said, to think that telling people to fight like hell, and then more importantly even to me, is what he said after the riots, you know, just to telling them, we love you, now go home, you know, you're very special. It's just so clear that was an opportunity to disown and to repudiate, you know, just to say this was wrong, and he didn't take it after the fact. So to me, what he did afterwards is even more telling than what he did before. It's irrefutable in my mind.
Joe?
But
I mean, that's not what he's being charged with. He's being charged with inciting insurrection. And, you know, and that's a very specific thing. If there were actually a legal case, and this comes back to the propriety of the impeachment, you know, the thing that really ought to happen is if somebody can make a criminal legal case against Donald Trump, that should be made. There's no bar whatsoever to that happening. You know, if we come back to this issue of do we want what's essentially going to be a bunch of Democrats in the Senate saying they think Donald Trump is a bad guy, you know, or we want more Republicans in the Senate to join their Democratic colleagues and say we think Donald Trump is a bad guy. Well, okay, great. How many people who now like Donald Trump will even, you know, will have their opinions of Donald Trump or of his conduct change when, let's say, Mitt Romney joins Chuck Schumer to say he thinks Donald Trump is a terrible guy?
Lori, thanks for your call. An email here from Patrick. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Jean. Jump in. Yeah.
Yeah, I would just take exception to that because Mitch McConnell has said that he thinks Trump committed an impeachable offense. Will he vote that way? We don't know. But the sentiment is there even among Republicans. It's not a matter of just I like Trump or I don't like Trump. And, you know, the trauma that the members of Congress experienced is real. And the threat that they felt is very real. And that's why you saw 10 Republicans in the House who, not a matter of like or dislike, they experienced what happened. And they concluded that Trump bore some responsibility. So I think this is a really serious matter that they're addressing.
We'll go to Dan calling from Brewer. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a quick question. If I were to send somebody into a place and tell them, hey, take that guy out of there, he ends up killing them, doesn't that make me accessory to murder? And if so, why is Trump getting away with this? Because I think an impeachment isn't even enough for that man. And I voted for him the first time, and I'm ashamed that I did. I'll hang up and wait for your answer.
Okay, Jean.
Well, that was one of the arguments that Trump's defense attorneys were trying to make, that this is, you know, if you think you can prove this case, well, then why isn't it in some other forum and not here on the Senate floor? So, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, Joe is, so maybe he has smarter insights into this.
Joe?
I'm a PhD political scientist. I'm not a lawyer, but I do teach law classes. You know, you'd have to show some kind of, I think, close connection, right? You'd have to, we probably need a real attorney to give us a better account of this. You know, I haven't actually seen it argued that he should be criminally charged. And, you know, if there's any evidence of coordination between the groups that breached the Capitol and the president's office, that would make a criminal prosecution likely, in my view.
We'll go to JD calling from Appleton. JD, we're almost out of time, so if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Hey, I just, for my family, it was like a 9/11 happened again. This was one of the biggest things. We were glued to our TV. If you look at when 9/11 happened, the Capitol was one of their initial targets. I mean, the equivalent happened. I can't understand how half the country doesn't feel that hollowness. Thank you.
Jean.
Well, polls do show that a majority of Americans think that president should be held accountable, but who knows how good polling is these days. And I think Joe does make a good, valid point, though, that partisans are going to be partisans and, you know, try to look the other way and try to justify their position one way or the other. But I agree with the caller. This is a serious moment here. You know, five people are dead. 140 police officers were injured. The building was broken. This was a serious attack mm-hmm. on our legislature and a serious attempt to disrupt a peaceful transfer of power, which is the very heart of our democracy. So I agree with the caller. This is a big deal. This is a serious moment.
And that is our last word. Thank you to both of you for being guests today. Jean Cummings, the voice you just heard, political editor at The Wall Street Journal, and Joe Reissert with Colby College's Government Department. He's a professor and director of the Integrated Studies Program. Today's sound engineer was George Thomas. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.